noisy kitchen timer against his microphone. "The first circular saw," he spoke in the same intimate voice he used on Crosby by Request. Then he began the countdown, and Clover, without any warning, collapsed her shoulders and drew her finger across her Botticelli neck. "But of course she knew," I thought. "She must. The circular saw had been designed by a woman. You could rely on her to know a thing like that, and it was unforgivable in this particular instance that I should beat her to it. I would not be let off. I was my own worst enemy, but I was also the show pony, and I released the first answer in stages in the way I had been coached. "Designed by a shaker," I said. "Good grief," cried Deasy. "A woman." "And off he goes." My opponent's eyes were now bright with emotion. She was nodding at me, smiling, encouraging. But what would that mean when the show was over? She had no idea how I wished to lose. What Deasy understood, I did not know. He slapped his head. "Gee up," he cried. I cared only about Clover now. What was happening behind that furry microphone? I couldn't tell. Deasy was frustrated with me, without a doubt. "Up, up and away," he cried. He asked a question about carbon paper. I looked to Clover, who seemed to nod. Carbon paper had been created to help blind people write. Off he goes. But I did not wish to be the winner. "Why so glum, O genius?" When the show was over, I got my fake check, and Clover received her real one, and asked to use the lav. I was slow to understand. I could not invite her to a picture show today. She had left the key in the lavatory door and run down the stairs to the street. Then I, of course, was required to have sandwiches at the Windsor with Mr. Deasy, who, in a strange fit, had once kissed me on the mouth. We were both subdued. Mr. Deasy refrained from his usual reports, but I inferred Coca-Cola had stopped nibbling and become a bait robber. Even when he revealed his eldest son had won pre-selection for a seat in Parliament, he remained forlorn. I bolted my second egg sandwich of the day and was back on the crowded train at 4:58 p.m., arriving in the Marsh at the so-called wobbly hour. Chapter 11. The wobbly hour began at exactly 6 p.m., after which it was an offence for a pub to serve a single glass of beer. The parliamentary intention of that law had been to force the drinkers home to dinner and the bosom of their families. The accidental consequence was the 6 o'clock swill, in which all those frothing glasses purchased when still legal were set in line and consumed, one after the other, in what was known as the period of grace. "For sin will have no dominion over you, since you are not under law but under grace." When the period of grace expired, then began the wobbly hour. Thus Bennett Ash might explain to me, "I couldn't do it, sir. My dad had his wobbly boots on." At the wobbly hour, I cycled home through the dark streets. The fallen leaves were in piles and burning, and the spitting rain produced sad odours of wet coal dust and ash and mould. Dangerous headlights burned my back as I hunched against the drizzle. I passed over the bridge on the Werribee River, past the cold, discoloured swimming pool, with my mind flicking through the pages of Oceania. Excepting some engravings and that postage stamp portraying 1 pound Jimmy, I had never seen an Aboriginal. They were all far away in dusty history, or in hot places where they threw stones at passing cars. But if they had once dwelled on the Corroit Creek, they had also been here on the Werribee, just there, behind the changing sheds below that empty chlorine swimming pool. They had walked where I was cycling now, when Jesus hung upon the cross. By Eric Redrop's isolated barber's shop, I escaped the front bumper of a speeding truck, then pedalled illegally on the footpath as far as Simon's Corner, where a streetlight revealed a solitary boy, or so I imagined, sheltering beneath the butcher shop veranda. Was this one more tea-time victim of the wobbly boot? "Mr. Barkhuber?" Bless me, it was Mr. Bobbs. I crossed the main street as a semi-trailer descended on me, air brakes farting, gears changing, hurtling down Stamford Hill. As I reached safety, the high-beam headlights revealed the Bobsy with his brilliantined hair swept upwards in a comic book of shock. What on earth had happened to him? "I am a man without a car," he cried. "Then we're both in the same predicament." I spoke lightly, but I smelled the booze on him and thought, dear goodness, it is Icarus crashed into the sea. "It was impossible, Mr. Barkhuber, so the expert said." "Hop on." I pointed the front wheel towards him, thereby indicating I could give him a ride home. Too late, I saw he was attached to a Hessian bag, which he lifted with him as he sprang onto the bar. He almost tipped us into the gutter. "Hold steady, Mr. Bobbs." He could not have been a heavy man, but whatever he carried in his sack made him difficult to balance. I set off just the same. "In the land of potato farmers, you can never sell an XK Jag." He turned his head to address me directly. "But ask me, where is the Jag?" He was an adult, the father of children. It would be rude to instruct him to sit still. "Ask me, is it up my sleeve?" "No, but there must be a trade-in. Where have I parked the trade-in?"
"Steady there, Mr. Bobbs. There's a car behind us."
"No trade-in," he cried. "But that's impossible." I could hear tyres hissing, windscreen wipers slapping. Then, as the car drew alongside, he kicked a leg at it. "But do you see a trade-in here? If you can find it, that's where I'd lose money on the deal."
We were opposite the Shire Chambers, by the crowded footpath outside the Royal Hotel. I lurched left, wobbled into Young Street, got safely to Bennett Street, where he held his chaff bag high.
"I have done what cannot be done," he said, perhaps intending to make a magician's gesture, although the consequence was that the Malvern Star hit a deep concrete drain, and we all flew, flesh and steel, landing hard, tangled up together. Drain water filled my shoes. I didn't yet know that I had torn my new Fletcher Jones trousers, but I could feel I had grazed my shin and palm. My neighbour crawled further along the drain, dragging his chaff bag behind him. There he sat, cross-legged beneath a streetlight as blood descended from his brilliantine. "Come on," I said, "I'll get you home." "No home," he said. "You listen. First I thought I would sell it to Halloran. That was last night." He wouldn't budge no matter what I did. Finally we sat together, cross-legged, in the drain. The rain continued. I learned that Halloran had been a perfect prospect in every way, possessing not only income but a well-known passion for the latest vehicle. However, the show-off builder was over 6 feet tall, with the result that, once he'd squeezed himself into the driver's seat, his big boof head poked up above the windscreen. His mates all barracked him unmercifully from the dark doorway of the pub. "Pull in your head," they called, "and pull in your elbow." But neither head nor elbow could be pulled inside the car, and the prospect's knees pressed up under the dash and rubbed against the steering wheel.
"I'm not a bloody contortionist," he said.
He could not easily operate the clutch, but he was, at the same time, a keen reader of wheels and modern motor, and he couldn't deny himself the chance to unleash that legendary engine on the road. Alas,
When truly tested, he lacked the ear and sensitivity to drive without synchromesh, and his fellow drinkers cheered each time he crashed the gears. It was no deal, no sale, no luck, and Bob's had to go home to the missus with a vehicle he couldn't easily explain.
"That was last night," he said. "I crashed and burned." Stupidly, I asked him to explain.
So he continued with the story of his day until even I lost patience and got him propped against the sale yard fence. I gave him my hanky for the blood. Then he was busy collecting the spilled contents of his chaff bag. "Pine cones," he explained. "Nothing like them to light a fire." I straightened up the front wheel and together we set off, both drenched to the skin, me walking the bicycle, him dragging the pine cones behind. Mrs. Bobbs must have heard the gate. She met us, red-eyed, weeping in her housecoat. The children were in great distress, the little boy howling in anguish, the pale daughter comforting her mother, who seemed to believe against all evidence that she was now the mother of two orphans. My presence did not staunch the widow's grief. She compelled her husband into a kitchen chair.
"Impossible," he said.
"Yes." She bathed his wound and anointed him with red salves and yellow tinctures and kneeled beside him. "My darling little Titch, what have they done? What has happened to the vehicle?" Only then did she see the bag, which she kicked at with her little slippered foot. "What's this?"
"Pine cones," he said, "for the fire. If I can do this, I can do anything."
"We have a gas fire," she said. I sensed the necessity to flee a private scene, but I was conscripted by the boy, who rolled up his pajama pants so I could apply to him his father's salve or sacrament. The girl made tea. The salesman's hair was now moulded flat upon his perfect head. His forehead and brow were painted red and yellow. He sat suddenly on the linoleum floor and pulled his snotty little son onto his lap and wiped his face. The boy wanted the pine cones, but his father removed a fat white envelope from inside his jacket. "Get your sister to help you count it." I remained at the table between the boy and girl as they counted out the largest amount of cash I had ever seen. 10-pound notes, huge fivers on the kitchen table. "I could never sell it," said Titch, still on the floor. "Impossible." Mrs. Bobbsey kneeled close by Mr. Bobbsey, alternately dabbing his head and kissing his hand. "I thought you'd killed yourself in that horrid thing. What did I say I would do this morning?"
"You said you'd take it back and pay the interest. Then you would chat to Ford about our franchise."
"And what did I do instead?"
"You made a brilliant deal, of course."
"Is this a deal?" the boy asked, and although he continued to repeat his question, no one answered him.
"But who?" his wife said. "Not Halloran, so who?"
In spite of his family's obvious adoration, the returning hero was, I slowly realized, reluctant to say who had provided these banknotes now stacked in three piles according to denomination. Mrs. Bobbsey pushed his shoulder. "Who? Can I have a cup of tea? Was it Mrs. Marcus?"
"Cuppa first."
But Mrs. Bobbsey's face had hardened. "What would she want with a car like that? Can she even drive it?"
Her husband shrugged.
"I suppose she wants driving lessons again."
"She has a license."
"She had a license last time."
"Irene," he pleaded, "were you drinking up there with her at Mount Egerton?"
"Pine cones," she cried. "We have a gas fire."
"I'm a salesman."
"You left the car with her? What about the registration and insurance? She didn't drive you back to the marsh?"
Something had happened. Everything had changed.
Suddenly the children were to get to bed. Mrs. ushered them away, closed the door behind her, then opened it again. "You bastard," she said. "She gave you pine cones for the fire? You were meant to be on the phone to Ford."
MYOB, I thought.
Chapter 12. The arrival of the Bobbseys had placed a greater stress on both my normal and abnormal customs. For instance, no knock or thump would have previously persuaded me to show myself to any bailiffs lurking on my front veranda. Now I was drawn out of hiding by the Bobbsey boy playing with his wooden truck. "Bobby," I cried. He jumped off the veranda and considered if he would run out the gate. I pushed myself into view and stood with dried hydrangea petals on my trousers. "It's a race," he said at last. "Who with?" "100 trucks," he frowned. "Round about that chair. I'm Ronnie." "Can I play?" He thought that might be possible. So I crawled around my veranda and soiled the knees of my second-best trousers. A few days later, I heard an extremely light, rather scratchy signal on my door. Clearly not a bailiff, more likely a boy with a truck to race. When I saw the mail pushed beneath my door, I smiled. As I reached, the weathered envelope was snatched away. Ronnie was fishing for me, as if I were a yabby who could be drawn from his creek with lamb fat tied to a piece of string. "Little bugger," I thought, and waited for the envelope to reappear, and then I grabbed it. "Got you," I cried, flinging open the door. Dear Lord, there was Miss Cloverdale, her bare knees on that day's copy of the Melbourne Sun. It was completely and totally inconceivable that she would ever be in this place. She should be 40 miles away, teaching history at the Methodist Ladies' College. But now she saw me in these wretched slippers, in this house, in this street. "Don't you pick up your mail?" The Sun's front page showed a mushroom cloud. A-bomb test at Woomera. These were the catastrophic tests at Maralinga, but I could not have been less interested. The top of my spine buzzed with excitement. Then she, Clover, was inside my hall, then in my front room, selecting books like a customer in auction rooms. Her calves shone in the somber light. "So," she said. Her eyes were wild and sooty. "What is it you want of me?" she demanded. She had picked up my copy of Maurice Bussett's On Avion Vols et Combat and seemed to examine the frontispiece before laying it aside. She chose another volume and dropped that too, and I saw she was inexplicably angry, or possibly frightened. There was an intimate ferocity completely new to us. "What about all this bloody dancing?" "You ran away," I said. "I waited." "No." "Yes. You came rushing out of the Windsor and looked straight at me. Then you pretended not to see me. For God's sake, it was dark." She laid her cool hand on my cheek, then withdrew it instantly. She returned her attention to my books. I saw my front room was a rat's nest and the floor was none too clean. In this poor place I had dreamed of holding her slender body, had imagined her skirt slipping like a petal to my familiar floor. I had imagined saying, "I love you." And here she was, and I was no longer sure that I loved her, and I felt not the intimacy of a beloved, but the shell of otherness. She moved from table to shelf, discarding the Sun and its mushroom cloud, examining my books, perhaps imagining their lonely owner with holes in his socks, at street stalls and auction houses, understanding that I was not who she had expected, but a pathetic hoarder facing the abyss of an empty life. "You should have a bookshop," Maybe I will. This one is from the State Library of Victoria.
Indeed.
It had been a gift from the map librarian.
Are you a thief, then?
She removed her shoes, as she so often did in the studio, and I was shocked to see those gorgeous, perfect feet touch my dirty floor.
I really didn't see you outside the Windsor. I thought you had run away.
Show me the house, she decided, and carried her shoes down the hallway.
Don't go into the kitchen.
Of course, she walked directly to the kitchen, where the lino was as sticky as flypaper.
Sugar, I explained.
And she was separating her perfect feet from my adhesive floor, making and breaking contact and looking out across my little garden.
You should clip their wings.
I had a chipped enamel basin, in which I was accustomed to washing the dirt off my potatoes, and I now filled this with warm water from the tap. I shuffled around the borders of the sugar spill, placed the bowl on the table, and brought a towel and a bar of soap.
"Oh, Willie," she said, and her upper lip looked slightly swollen. "Are you going to give me a bath?"
She was laughing at me, and I was so full of blood I could hardly see her. She sat on my least damaged kitchen chair. I boldly placed the bowl of water by her feet, and she peered down curiously. When she handed me the soap, I could not understand her eyes, but they did not seem inclined to look away, not even as she placed her bare feet in the water. I wished it had been new soap, not worn and old like this. I kneeled. I lifted her left foot. She permitted me this intimacy. I washed her pink soles and the soft shadows between her toes. I soaped her round, slim heel, and then her calf, and when I finally looked up, I found her thoughtful eyes. She reached to touch my cheek, and then I stood, and then she stood, and I took her dry hand in my wet one, and found myself not exactly present in the world. "Can you see me, Willie?" I led her back into the hallway. "Are we dancing? The floor is cleaner back here." She showed nothing but curiosity about where I led her, to my unmade boy's bed, 2 foot 6 inches wide, books nestled in amongst the sheets. "Read to me," she said, and there were practical reasons I was relieved, and I found the Persian poet, and we lay together on my rumpled sheets, and she rested her head upon my chest, and I stroked her hair with my left hand, while I held the slightly puffy, water-damaged volume with my right. It was 12 ghazals by the Persian poet Hafez. I read, and she kissed me on the cheek, and my body arched in frank desire. "Go on," she said. I did. "If I go after her, she stirs up a fuss, and if I hang back, she rises in wrath. And if, in desire, for a moment on the road, I fall as dust at her feet, she flees like the wind. And if I seek out but half a kiss, 100 evasions pour out like sugar from the pearl case of her mouth." "Sugar," she said. Then Hafez was done. And I must read Neruda, then Christina Rossetti, then E.E. Cummings, then Walt Whitman, then John Donne, then William Shakespeare, and we rose to eat buttered toast until there was no more butter and it was getting dark. Our stomachs were rumbling. I left to feed the chooks and returned with eggs, but she had grown up on a poultry farm and could not bear the taste of them. At dusk, we walked down Gell Street in secret, past the Hunchback's bright fish and chip shop, thence into the main street. I had not pushed myself on her, but I was a man, and therefore overflowing with calculation, and I had hoped against hope that Frank Benelack had not closed the door of his chemist shop. Too late. We walked slowly along the main street without touching. Clover folded her arms across her breasts and recalled certain stories to do with Giotto. We were thrilled to discover we were both admirers of the intemperate autobiography of Benvenuto Cellini. Outside the courthouse, her elbow bumped my arm. She was wonderfully infuriated that Vasari had so patronized Uccello. It was now dark, but the blacksmith was still working. The chime of his hammer was always, to my ears, the equal of the songs of magpies, the wrens and butcher birds that gave the town its deceptive sense of peace. A single car travelled slowly past us. The second chemist's shop was closed. It would have tested me, in any case, to ask for what I wanted from people who knew me as a bachelor. After the chemist was the cruel dentist, and after the dentist was Mrs. Hallowell's lolly shop, then Simon's garage, with its forest of petrol pumps, all different species, some with glass reservoirs and hand pumps, Neptune, Caltex, Golden Fleece, Plume, Ampol, sad and faded, corner property for rent or sale. On the opposite corner was the old Merimou Café, known as The Greeks, but owned by Ben Calvo, a Jew who had survived the homicidal German army in Salonika. Ben's haircut, courtesy of Eric Redrop, did no favours to his ears and made no attempt to hide the deep creases up his neck and skull. As we entered the café, it was clear he had seen us coming. His smile had taken possession of his swarthy face, and his frown was rushed down towards the bump of his mighty nose. I was embarrassed already before he demanded to be introduced, but then he made things worse. When Clover said hello, Ben cried, "The voice!" He took her hand without a "by your leave" and led her to inspect the framed photographs of local legends. Carr, the famous local bicyclist, Jackson, who won the Starwell gift, Dangerous Dan's crash course on the Bacchus Marsh racecourse. The main street flooded, the Woolpack Inn where they had changed horses for the stagecoaches of Cobb and Company. And there he pointed my place out, a pale patch on the wall. "Tell him to let me put it back," he said, now to Clover. "Why not let us admire him?" "I think he's on the run," she said, a little flirty. I thought, please don't encourage him. He'll want to join us. But he was a nicer man than that. He knew I didn't drink, but perhaps in order to aid me in my wooing, served us illegal wine in teacups. We sat in the booth next to the Grant Street window and affected to believe the homemade plonk was Chianti, and we were in Firenze looking out at the Duomo, rather than Simon's garage, and that we, framed by the windows, suspended above the footpath, were the Duke and Duchess of Urbino, Federico da Montefeltro and his wife, Battista Sforza, in majestic profile. We trod lightly around the edges of our pasts. We did not discuss the schismatic Lutheran churches of Adelaide or the poultry farms of Dandenong, but we were, I believe, so very happy with each other that we failed to see Mrs. Bobsey park her car opposite. Thus I was shocked to notice the light appear on the upper floor of Simon's garage and see quite a different painting, framed in a high bright window, of Mrs. Bobsey in the arms of a strange man.
Chapter 13. From the time of her first marriage, my sister cheated on her household expenses and maintained rainy day bank accounts, not only in Geelong, but in Colac and Winchelsea. She had kept her earlier engagement rings and knew their resale value. She was always married, then abandoned. It would have caused offence for me to say it was her fault, i.e., you keep your husband because he is a treasure, and the more that is true, the more there will be other women after him. You see off the other women, is what I should have said. So it was up to me to give Mrs. Marcus her driving lesson and give her back her pine cones. I told her, to her face, I have no problem starting a fire in my own home. I got home at lunchtime to find the heavy black telephone ringing. Below it were all Titch's worry papers. There was no handwriting quite like his. Finance calculations, the names of prospects with the capital and smaller letters all jumbled together in a language of their own. It was Mr. Dunstan.
"Your husband can never be the Ford dealer in Bacchus Marsh."
I thought, what have I done?
"The franchise is allocated elsewhere."
He was so jubilant it made me ill. "How can you know this?"
"If he wants to play now, he has to play with GMH. It's exactly what you wanted, Mrs. Bobbs. It's everything we hoped. Ipso facto, QED. He's a Holden man today."
I thought, poor sweet Titch, betrayed by your awful father, now your wife as well.
"We've bagged the number one country salesman in the state. We've bagged the little bugger."
"Don't call him that."
"No disrespect."
"And you haven't bagged him. He doesn't even like the Holden. You don't know him."
"It's not personal, Mrs. Bobbs, but this is what they call checkmate. You've been a major player on the team."
This was the actual point at which I wrecked our lives. Dunstan himself would play a major role, as would Thacker and Mr. Green. But I was the one who unlocked the door for them. On top of that, I got the capital. I had steeled my heart against my sister, because I thought it was my right to do so, because half the house was mine, because she had abused my generosity, travelling up to Melbourne and running up bills at Myers and George's.
"You know your family's future is with Holden," said Dunstan.
He had a deep, slow voice. It would have calmed a yappy dog.
"We're getting closer every day, Irene," he said.
He had never called me Irene before, and I didn't mind so much. He said he was driving up to Ballarat tonight and would pass through the marsh at 6 o'clock.
"You'll never guess what I have to show you," he said. "Everything is falling into place."
Whoa, I thought.
"My cousin is an Anderson," he said.
Anderson was a big Bacchus Marsh family. Of course I knew the name.
"She is married to George Halloran."
I knew Halloran, of course. He had built a scandalous extension for Mrs. Marcus.
"Halloran is going to develop the site of Simon's Garage."
He said Simon's Garage was a perfect place for a dealership. A corner property, petrol tanks already in the ground, a hoist in place, and the failed bicycle factory was just waiting to be a workshop. Plus, there was a loft, which, according to his cousin, could be turned into a cosy flat for proprietor and family.
"The lease won't cost a penny until you take possession."
"We can't afford it."
"Yes, you can. You'll have the cash flow of a major dealership and GMAC behind you with the financing."
In my defence, this was what Titch and I had both talked about when we were still living in a boarding house in Bairnsdale. Our own Bob's Motors with a display space for 4 vehicles, with the lights on all night long. "My husband would go nuts," I said. "He won't tolerate the debt."
"No, no, don't worry. Come and look at the site."
"Don't underestimate him, Mr. Dunstan. He is not a timid man, believe me."
"I'll be in Marsh at 6 tonight. Come by yourself. When you see it, you'll understand."
Oh, Jesus, I thought. I didn't know where Titch was. He was meant to talk to Ford that morning, but he wasn't home. I don't think my husband heard from Ford.
"He did, yes."
Then why was he not here? What pub was he in now?
Mrs. Bobbs, Dunstan said. If you were my wife, then I'd be very, very grateful. I'd know you had saved my life.
I arranged to meet Dunstan in the early evening, expecting Titch would be there to go with me. At dusk, he was still not home. Mrs. Wilson across the road was not exactly friendly, but said the kids could sit at her kitchen table. So I went to meet with Dunstan alone. His voice had suggested a tall, slow man, but in the murk of Simon's doorway he smelled of mint and whiskey. A wiry, bald fellow with a 2-inch-high moustache. He stamped his feet and clapped his hands and frightened me. The beam of his torch swept across the heavy steel beams and concrete floors. What was I meant to think? I could make out a shadowy mess of chairs stacked to the ceiling. The lights came on. I saw tea chests and a workshop bench where someone had been turning bookends on a lathe. I told Dunstan that this was not for me to judge. I would have a better idea if it was a cow. He said I would grasp the value of the property if I came up the stairs, and it was there he finally turned to face me. Dear God, did he mean to propose to me? He was holding out a little velvet box.
"We want to thank you," he said.
I thought, it's pearls. But it was a fancy pen with my name engraved on it.
No, I can't. You must.
No one must ever know, I said, and it was true.
No one need know, he agreed and grasped my hand.
And I said quit it, but his mouth looked spoiled and sulky beneath its bed of hair. He was a married man. He wore a ring. He was kissing me, pushing his thing against my stomach, the idiot, with his awful-tasting mouth. I pulled away, but still he slobbered on my cheek, and I looked down on Grant Street and saw, in the window of the Greeks, Mr. Bakhuba looking directly at me.
"We will go home now," I said. "You will tell this to my husband."
Dunstan took a step backwards, as if taking stock of me and who I was, and what he might finally do to me, or I to him. I had a ladder in my stockings. Let him stare at that.
"You thought I was a cheat," I said. "You thought I was cheating on my husband by confiding in you. I was wrong. I never should have."
"Oh, no, it's just a fountain pen. From all of us at GMH.
I didn't bother to call him a liar or make him more of my enemy than he already was. I told him to follow me in his car, but when we turned the corner onto Gisborne Road, I thought, what if Titch is still not home? Or if he's drunk? I pulled off the road and waited for the pervert to come back and talk to me.
"You have to return later," I said. "I have to tell him what I have done with my sister."
He stood there in the darkness, staring at me. That was Dunstan. From the very start, he thought I was a pain. Chapter 14. I waited for my husband. The silly quiz show finished, and then Crosby by request, and then a pair of headlights washed down the drive, and I stood at the back door and saw my Titchy was alive. In the bright light of the shed, I watched him perform his customary inspection of the tyres and Duco. He met me at the door and I hugged him, knowing how the rejection must be hurting.
"No Ford," was all he said.
"Good riddance," I said. "We'll do something even better."
I nuzzled my nose behind his perfect ear, and before he even had his coat off, I told him what I had done with my parents' estate. My share was all for him. I said so. He said I was an amazing woman. I had changed the game completely. It was lovely to see this was not the broken man I feared, but the one I married, the one I loved. He flipped the cap off a bottle. He grinned. He teased me. He found a penny in a private place, and I let him be the way he was. We finished our beers and I washed the glasses, and we were husband and wife, warm in bed while the wind raged around us. But he would not say what I had changed. I didn't worry very much. I expected he was going to buy more used vehicles from Joe Sacker. That was how he thought. It was early morning when the phone rang, and I thought it would be Sacker. But it was Dunstan asking for Mr. Bobbs, as if he didn't know me. Ronnie was awake, so I rushed him out to the shed to help me blacken tyres. Then Titch finally appeared in his striped pyjamas. I sent Ronnie back inside.
"That was GMH," he said.
"What did they want?"
"Strange timing, don't you think? Day after Ford."
He was looking at me funny.
"He knew all about me somehow."
I waited, nervous.
"His name is Dunstan."
"That was your game-changing idea? You're going to GMH?"
"Irene," he said. "I got the entry papers for the Red X trial."
There was no money in the Red X trial. It was all for skites and show-offs, men who got drunk off printer's ink and headlines, public heroes who could afford the luxury of fame. It was for publicity hounds like Dangerous Dan. It was a so-called reliability trial, which punished ordinary production cars and made them do things they were never meant to do. Of course it was a big thrill for the so-called general public. 200 lunatics circumnavigating the continent of Australia. More than 10,000 miles over outback roads so rough they might crack your chassis clean in half. I told my husband what I thought.
"I knew you'd be like this," he said. "But it would make our name."
"We've got a name. It's Bob's. It's time to shift to Holden."
"But we've got the money from your parents' house."
I thought, now he's stuffed up everything I've done.
"I picked up the entry papers yesterday. When I left Ford, I went down to Melbourne. For Christ's sake, listen. Ford cut my knackers off. I need something to look forward to."
"I'm sorry about Ford," I said. "But we're not gambling. That's agreed. We've got to make a living."
"Calm down."
"No, it's my money."
"You said it was for me."
"We've got two kids. It's around Australia, 18 days. All you're left with is a wreck."
"Don't you see? It could make us famous. That's the value. The fellow thought it was a good idea."
"What fellow?"
"Dunstan. He could see the business sense of it. If we were Holden dealers."
"He never."
And he was laughing. "We've got it," he said, and lifted me in the air and carried me, walking on gravel and bare feet. "Tell me it's impossible. Holden franchise, Red X trial. You beauty bottler, Irene. You saved our bacon."
And he was kissing me, and my feelings were all confused by what I knew and didn't know. How could we go in the Red X and leave the kids? What made him think we'd win?
"Talk to this Dunstan," he said. "Listen to what he says."
"We can't start a dealership and then run away."
"This is going to take months and months of prep. At the same time, there's building to be done. We'll come back from the trial to open the new showroom."
I didn't ask him what building, because of course I knew. "So this Mr. Dunstan, he's going to look after Ronnie and Edith? He's going to tuck them in and hear their prayers?"
"I'll solve it. I've got months to sort it out."
"You'll go away and leave me."
"We'll be co-drivers," he said,
with those bright, keen eyes and his thin pajamas, and I could feel how much he wanted me.
"You watch," he said. "We're going to be a household name."
Who would have thought what the sight of us, this private moment, would do to someone else? Who might imagine that a well-educated schoolteacher might see this confusion as the ideal model for a modern life?
Chapter 15.
That was the first time I saw Dunstan. I didn't know his name, of course, but I wished I never saw Mrs. Bobsey in the mongrel's arms. It churned me up to think, Titch, a cuckold? So I, who had previously coveted his wife, now wished to perform some act of unexpected kindness. To wash his car, for instance. Anything. In the cafe, Clover had been unable to fathom why I was upset. You're sweet on her? How could I explain that I had been in love with the idea of Titch Bobsey, his Jaguar, his wife, his children tumbling across the grass in the middle of the night? Her husband is my friend. Clover's upper lip contracted, and I was moved to place my finger there on that entrancing mole. She wished I wouldn't. Your beauty mark, I said, as she removed my hand. It is a mark of sin, according to my mother. It's certainly persuasive. No, it's not funny. Your sin? I told my mother, if it's not my sin, it must be yours. She slapped my face. Ha! Exactly. I thought, what unknown winds have delivered our spirits to our bodies? Come on, she said. It's time. Time for what? As we rose from the booth, I thought, you do not know her. You will say you love her because of something brainless, like a lovely clavicle. Bones, I thought, as we entered the darkness of Gisborne Road, up the hill where the air was damp and cool and smelled of rotting leaves and the excretions of cattle and attendant horses who had recently passed that way. Mare urine is an aphrodisiac for stallions, so Ben Calvo says. He owes his cafe to his knowledge of racecourse matters, so perhaps this will prove true. The doors of the chemist shops had been locked, but we walked as if they were open to our desire, arm in arm, and by the Church of England graveyard, where we stopped to kiss. Sex makes a man dishonest with himself, as is well known. I feared the slippery ambiguity of false feeling, of expediency, of things not being exactly true. We entered the front gate of my house and squeezed down the side by the hydrangeas, and I smelled her soft neck, imagining rooms and places beyond my life. In the smudgy dark, I spied my sleeping chooks, chalky lumps up on the roof. I'll clip their wings, she said, before I go. Once inside, I was deaf with worry about the chemists and my disfigured shoulder. I drew blinds and curtains everywhere, and she smiled at me, and I wished she would not see my awful scar. She kicked off her shoes. I could not imagine what she thought. Say we were in Italy. What then? In the kitchen we embraced, and she held me close and breathed my breath and said that was how you know a person was right. She was so lithe and exceptionally beautiful and gentle, and with her hands clasped around my shoulder blades, she pulled herself up into my life. I said we could not do what we both wished. That's for the girl to say. Not without a thing. You've got a very nice thing, as far as I can feel. Then my veins and arteries were full to bursting, but I'd rather kill myself than play this game. Then we were on the bedroom floor, among the books, like teenagers, and I said, outright, plainly, the problem was the absence of the contraceptive. She said there were lots of ways to skin a cat, but she did not understand I was who I was because, once upon a time, I had been a boy. I had spurted in a second like a sparrow. I spilled my seed, but not upon the ground. I trusted my secrets to those glistening, observant eyes. I confessed. Adelina Koenig and I had been just 20 years old when she got pregnant and we ran away to Melbourne. I had assumed we would have the baby there. It was Adelina, the nurse, who found the abortionist. I did not know such men existed. Poor children, Clover said. How awful.
What a lot of money you had to find. I was touched she would accept my ugly secrets. I confessed that I had borrowed the money from Sebastian Lasky, who I didn't know well enough to ask so much of, but who would, more than once, descend into the wreckage of my life to save me. "You're an attractive man," she said. "You will always be forgiven." She helped me remove my shirt, and there was no choice but to reveal the scar, that brutal wound like a fissure in a concrete slab. She licked it, as deep as she could go. She loved me. She said so. She sucked my nipples like I was a girl. I moaned. I thought, the power of sex cannot be denied, stopped or plugged. It is as insistent as water leaking through a roof, finding its way in darkness, emerging in the back seat of a car. There was nothing to be frightened of. She said, no, I thought. Only what it makes you do, clawing at the trees, splintering the bark like a tomcat, the blind and violent need of it, a joy, but who would not want to be relieved of it? I pity the Catholic priests, suffering their sex, the stream of desire finding its way to the ocean without regard to good or evil, and if it ends up as evil, then that is the relentless nature of it. The cat was flayed alive. Hours later, still on the floor, we talked and talked, kissed and cried, and my wound must be examined, and my tumble from the kitchen window lived again, and Adelina Koenig also must be described. "It means king," she said. "I know. But you must have had another baby. That's why you're hiding from the summonses now." He turned out not to be my child. Any moment I thought, she will not love me any more. How could anyone be certain he wasn't your son? Just say the baby was red-headed and that my wife was not. I could see she was about to argue, and I would not tolerate it. And there was a red-haired bloke who was always at your house. What did Adelina say? I wished she wouldn't use her name. You left her, is that correct? You don't understand, I said, but I saw her face and it was clear she did. Poor Willie. I'm sure she suffered, and he suffered too, the poor little blighter. How old are you, Willie? 26. You're too young for all this guilt. See, look, you're ready. In self-defence, I summoned an urgent interest in my grandmother's coloured atlas of the Holy Roman Empire. I laid it before her, and she admired it, and listened to my unshakable belief that I did not belong where my mother had delivered me. I had no reason to be in the hot streets of wartime Adelaide, not when my true home must be in the atlas of the Habsburg Empire and the lands of Hungary. There was no map of Adelaide that could produce the longing aroused by the dense, fibrous universe of that atlas, which, being hand-painted in a slightly unconventional, if not eccentric, manner, had the mellow colours of a closely woven Persian rug, in which our red Hungary had turned a greyish-brown. Salzburg was the colour of dried straw. Croatia was pale pink. Bohemia, like the other states, was now foxed and speckled brown. The crumbling coast of Dalmatia in the south was what I believe is known as spectrum violet. But of course, dear man, she herself had not belonged in Dandenong. There was her gorgeous silk-skinned leg, folded beneath her dark private hair, glistening with dew, and here were all of these lands with their diverse peoples, Germans, Magyars, Spanish Jews, Romanies, and Mohammedans, which had been a source of wonder to my childish imagination. My grandmother told me that an ancestor of ours, a Venetian nobleman, had been called to advise the Imperial Council in Vienna. What he had done there, or what became of him, we could never know. But he was the reason that I had curiously splayed Italian toes. And although blonde-haired, as my father the pastor, would turn brown as a Mediterranean berry in the Australian sun. Likewise, Clover was olive-skinned, but did not know, she told me, where she came from. She thought her grandfather had been in a poem by Wordsworth, perhaps in Troutbeck, and she had read compulsively but never found either poem or boy. Her grandmother was a real Cockney in Bow, but the address on her birth certificate had been bombed to dust in the Second World War. There were olive-skinned Scots and Irish, she supposed. Her great-grandmother had hated De Valera because he would not take off his hat to the Prince of Wales. She had a magpie history, bright pebbles with no bedrock. We know nothing. It is l'état australienne, she said. Think about the red-headed child. What might he ever know of how he came to be? I told her the father was an American nurse at the Royal Melbourne Hospital. He had been our friend. He was a good nurse, I thought, a good friend, I had imagined. And fucked your wife, she said. Dear God, how could I defend myself from that brutality? You should have killed him, she said, playing with my toes, rumpling the maps. Who knows what murderers we descend from? You will expect me to be repulsed by this, and yet this imaginary murder was an expression of passion, an expression of support, of love, a renewal of unresolved desire, and Lord, well, never mind. She drew a fine wet thread from my sex, and there was more than one way to skin the cat, and the walls were thin, and I did not care how she snorted or shouted out to God. When we finally rose from the floor, the Holy Roman Empire was in shreds, and, for the moment anyway, I really did not care.
Chapter 16. When my husband told me he was off to see a man about a dog, I assumed it was somehow related to the show-off Red X trial. It did not occur to me, not for a moment, that after all I had said, after all he had said, he was going back to Ford to try again. It was predictable, of course. This was how he was with his father, always going back to take another beating. It was morning. Edith was in strife for handing in a drawing in which all the kids were purple. No one wears purple, the teacher had said. She was allegedly old and crabby, and Edith was Edith. She had just pointed out that Barbara Radford had purple stripes in her sweater. Her teacher said Barbara Radford did not have a purple face. Edith did not wish to go to school. Ronnie was stamping around the house. Roundy bowdy, as he liked to say. He had never had real boots before, and he was mad with happiness, rushing outside to break the ice in the puddles and tramp mud back across the carpet. I walked them hand in hand to school. I returned intending to make a trunkline call to learn what Dunstan had said to Titch and what Titch had said to him. At home, I discovered there had been a chicken massacre next door. Huge white flowers, dead mounds of dusters, dead as dodos, and in the midst of all this sudden death in his veggie garden, wearing a woolen beanie in Bacchus March colours, stood Mr. Buck Hooper, grasping a dead creature to his chest. "We cut their wings," he said. On their first flightless morning, his chickens had been visited by next door's cocker spaniel. I don't see this was my fault, although I felt it. I did not ask him who was we. Titch was meanwhile travelling at 93 miles an hour towards new humiliation. I was at home, busy on the phone with Dunstan. I asked him why he had given in about the Red X. He needs something to look forward to, Dunstan said. Wasn't a dealership enough, I asked. He laughed. In Geelong, the big noises asked my husband what he was doing back with no appointment.
I have the capital, he said. That's nice, mate. Plus, I am going to win the Red X trial. Yes, but we have the franchise allocated, all signed up. Unsign him. Mate, no one can match my sales numbers.
Why was it, they asked him, that salesmen always imagined they were the center of the universe? This was not so. The Ford Motor Company required a Bacchus Marsh dealer with business acumen, as they called it, plus substantial capital, marketing know-how, promotional capability, real estate experience. Salesmen were a dime a dozen. Titch was not offended. He said so.